You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Friday the 24th of February. Ko Amanda Jane Robinson, tōku ingoa. My name is Amanda Jane Robinson. I am also joined in studio by producer Tess Barnett. On the show today, we'll be talking with Watercare Supply Manager Priya and Pereira. We'll also be talking about swimmable rivers with Green MP Catherine Delahunty. We're also going to have our weekly chat with National MP Jamie Lee Ross. We're going to be talking to him about swimmable rivers as well. And we're also going to be talking to him about the National Government running against the domestic violence leave bill last week. As usual, we'll have Radio Adelaide's Nicole Wedding for all the latest in Australian news. And lastly, we'll take a look at the Dakota Access Pipeline, also the history of Pride ahead of tomorrow's parade. But first up, we have Lillian Hanley on the line. So Lillian is live outside Nikki Rati's house in Glen Innes. Hi, Lillian.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Good, thanks.
So just for people who don't know, who is Nikki?
Nikki is a queer from Glen Innes who has lived in her state home in that community for 21 years. And recently she was given an eviction notice along with a number of people in that community who are being removed from their home as part of the Tāmaki Regeneration companies who have taken over ownership of 2,800 state homes from the government. Their sort of redevelopment program has been to remove a number of families from their homes so that they can be demolished and rebuilt. Problem is that this has been going on for about 5 years, and now in the community there is just a huge number of empty properties and nothing is really being done. So it's an issue of land banking pretty much to gain that kind of profit. But Nikki is a woman who has taken up the fight because she wants to stay in her home, basically, and that's what she is asking for. So she has occupied her home since that 90-day eviction notice ran out.
And so why are people gathered outside her house today specifically?
So this is a process that sort of started in January. So that 90-day eviction notice started in January. The 90-day eviction notice ran out in January and the first occupation started then. And so a number of people gathered to stay at her house and support and basically say that we're not going to leave. Now, what happened with that was that the company applied for a possession order before the 90-day eviction notice actually ran out, which isn't the proper procedure. So they had a hearing in January, which basically said that wasn't the proper procedure and that therefore it wasn't allowed, basically. So they had another hearing earlier this week where we thought that it was understood that they would be either granted the possession order or not at that day, and so earlier this week the occupation started again. But from that hearing it was decided that they would make a decision at the end of the week. And so yesterday the Ministry of Justice was contacted by somebody in the Tāmaki Housing Group, which is the group fighting the Tāmaki redevelopment, and it was made clear to them that a decision has been made, but nobody has notified Nikki as of yet. So today the call out went for people to come and occupy again, and so there's a number of people here basically waiting for that decision to be announced.
Right, and so what happens either way? What happens if the adjudicator rules in favour of Nikki? What happens if they rule against
her?
Well,
essentially at this point it seems that it's unlikely that this battle will be won in the courts because, I mean, it's quite a... If it was a sort of isolated case, perhaps, they may have been more lenient, but it's a wider systemic issue that's actually going on, and that's partly also why Nikki is making this stand, so that all people can actually stay in these homes that were given to them as homes for life. But the idea with this decision is basically that either the possession order will be granted or not, but it is highly likely that the possession order will be granted, and basically it's a matter of deciding whether they will come and remove her today, or they will give her time to sort her things, I suppose.
Right, and so the people that are there today, what's it kind of like there at the moment?
It's calm, but it's that feeling of a calm before a storm. I think people are feeling quite unnerved because they aren't sure what is happening, and because this is sort of being dragged out a little, and it can be quite distressing, especially if this is, you know, your home and you don't know what is going to happen by the end of the day. It's quite distressing, but there is a lot of people here and there's a lot of support, I think, for Nikki, so that's been really, really important. The only sort of police presence at the moment, there's some sort of cops around the corner, but the main thing has been the cop helicopter kind of circling every half an hour or so. So other than that, it's all quite chill.
Yeah, all right. Well, I guess we'll have to just wait and see what happens.
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much, Lillian.
No worries.
Talk to you later. That was supporter of Nikki Rauti, Lillian Hanley. Remember, if you have anything you'd like to add throughout the show, give us a text on 5395. Next up, 95BFM producer Tess Barnett spoke to Green MP Catherine Delahunty about the government's announcement regarding swimmable rivers.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
Decided to move the goalposts because they know that New Zealanders want swimmable rivers, but they didn't set a plan to create swimmable rivers. They set a plan for business as usual, the continual pollution of our waterways, by actually just saying that what used to be wadeable can now be called swimmable. So that's pretty disappointing, and I think New Zealanders have a right to be pretty upset about that.
Would you have preferred to see happen?
Well, we want genuinely swimmable rivers, so we don't want to see our rivers continue to be polluted. We want to change the national policy statement on fresh water to really swimmable, which means heading towards this figure called 260 E. coli. E. coli are the bugs that make people sick. So the government, they've instead of heading towards E260, have actually changed the goalposts that now 540 E. coli will be called swimmable. So that's not real action. We also want to make sure that we put a price on the commercial users of water who are sucking up our rivers and causing them to become algae-ridden little puddles instead of free-flowing water. We're really committed to helping farmers change to a cleaner farmer model. There's a lot of work that needs to go on. We're not against the planting and fencing that Nick Smith's proposing in his new package, but you know, it's not new because he's actually proposed it for the last 2 years. And it's a good idea, but it's not sufficient on its own. We have a lot of work we need to do to stop polluters and to make sure that we actually look after our water properly. So swimmable means swimmable.
So what needs to happen now in terms of the public? Like, how are people to know whether it's safe to swim or not?
Well, this is the tragedy of their stupid policy, to be honest. It's like, we need to protect water, the water cycle, not the spin cycle of the government. And unfortunately, the government's saying you just need to go to a website, and it's called the LAWA, Land and Water Aotearoa website, and just see whether your river is that day safe for swimming or not, so swimmable some of the time. And we don't think that's good enough. We don't think that the citizens should have to drive around the country checking websites to see whether they're going to get, 1 in 20 people will get sick at that site or not. It's very, very disappointing, and that's not the answer. People can make submissions on this paper that's been put out by the government yesterday, so it is possible if you go to the Ministry of Environment website to have your say. And we need people to have their say on swimmable rivers. They really need to tell the government what is their expectation. Like, that it should be something real, not 1 in 20 people but might get sick.
Yeah, for sure, and it needs to be something accessible for most people to go swimming. So like you said, it's not really accessible if you're driving around the country to be accessing the website.
I think that we need to treasure the places that are still clean, and we need to keep taking photographs where we see cows in water, algae blooms, but a lot of the pollution's invisible, so you do have to check, which is really, really, really disappointing. We should not have to check whether water's clean or not. There are places in this country which the government say are swimmable that are actually we would consider to be in a bad way, and there was a great article in the Christchurch Press, if people want to look it up on Stuff, by Charlie Mitchell about what that this policy actually means for the very stressed South Island rivers. But, you know, you shouldn't have to do this. You should be able to look at the river. It smells fresh. It's full of life. It's clean. And you can jump in and your kids can be jumping in without getting sick. And that's not the situation. That's the situation you'll get if you help us change the government and make sure that the Greens have a really strong voice in the next government, because water and clean rivers would be a top priority for us. I think somebody on Twitter said it well. They said, imagine going to a restaurant where 1 in 20 people got sick. Would you want to risk eating there? And that's really what the government's proposition is, 1 in 20 people. So, yep, that's not good enough. We can do better, and under the Greens' leadership, we certainly will.
Irirangi Pōhō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Green MP Catherine Delahunty talking about the government's announcement regarding swimmable rivers. We're also going to talk about that now with National MP Jamie Lee Ross. Hi, Jamie Lee. Hi, Jamie Lee.
Hi, Amanda. How are you going?
Good to see you. Good to talk to you too, rather. So swimmable rivers is kind of the big news of the week this week. So there's been a lot of kind of condemnation and controversy around this. Has there been a reduction in water quality for this classification of what is considered swimmable?
I'm not a technical expert, so I'm not going to go into E. coli levels and everything, but the Ministry for the Environment says no, the Minister says no. I understand some of the confusion or difference of opinion is around wadeable standards versus swimmable standards. The bottom line is, the goal is to get to 90% of all waterways being swimmable by 2040. We're currently at 72% of all waterways being swimmable, and so that's an increase. It also will require approximately $2 billion of costs that will be borne by government, local government, and dairy farmers and other farmers where they are putting in measures to reduce effluent flows to rivers, for example. So there's an improvement. That's the bottom line for people. There's an improvement, there's an aspirational goal of getting to 90%, and that's greater than what we have right now. And so we're moving forward, we're making progress, and I'm sure the experts will be working out the technical standards and how to look at them over the coming months.
Yeah, I think it has been talked about of this improvement, but is that an improvement to the water quality? It seems as if this announcement doesn't require any improvement to the water quality except for the very worst rivers, and instead changes that categorisation as what counts as swimmable or not. Is that correct?
I understand much of the changes in the standards relate to a standard around wadeability, whereas now the focus is on swimmability. If you're thinking about what's important to New Zealanders when it comes to waterways, it's not necessarily that they can wade in the water, but actually swim in the water. And to get to 90% by 2040 is pretty expensive, but a big goal. Some will say, why don't we go for 100% swimmability? Unfortunately, that's not practical or realistic. There are some lakes and waterways around the country where the natural environment means that through natural causes, they can't be swimmable. For example, there's some lakes down in the lower North Island where birds result in the water being unswimmable, and you just can't cull all the birds for that reason. So we're going for the 90% target. It's an improvement, currently 72%, and looking later on in our lives, Amanda, more waterways will be safer to swim in.
It's a good thing to hope for sure. I think just, yeah, speaking about birds as well, I know Forest and Bird came out against this announcement saying that at the moment the standard for the cleanest rivers allows a 1 in 100 chance of getting sick, and the proposal now is that there's possibly a 1 in 20 chance of getting sick as the top standard. How can that be?
Like, I respected Kevin Hague when he was an MP. He's a really good guy. But I'm not sure there's many matters where Forest and Bird and the National Government end up agreeing on. They're quite regular, quite a regular organisation that criticises the National Party. As I said, I'm not a technical expert. I can't take you through the E. coli levels, and I'm not going to try. I'd be misleading you if I did attempt that. We're putting more money into clean freshwater cleanup. $140 million has been announced by the minister yesterday too for freshwater cleanup. There's going to be stronger standards for farmers to keep their stock away from rivers. There's going to be more funding through local government for cleaning up waterways too. We are making the waterways cleaner over the long term, and that's a good thing for New Zealand. I can't take you through E. coli standards though, Amanda. I'm just not a technical expert on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Minister and Forest and Bird disagree. The Ministry for the Environment and some other bodies disagree on this. We're putting more money into it though, and we will see clean the rivers.
All right, that's good to know. So moving on now, last week we didn't get a chance to talk, but I do want to touch on something that we'd planned to talk about, and that was the government's decision not to back the domestic violence leave bill, which would give victims of domestic abuse 10 days of paid leave to help them kind of improve their situation. Why did National decide not to support this bill?
First, I think Jan Logie's onto something good that many employers are already doing, but we just come down on the side of should be for the employers to decide to make this available, and many have, and for the government to go and require every single business in the country to make 10 days available, it could come at quite a significant cost. And we know through historical research that if you increase costs to businesses substantially in one big hit, it could lead to actual job losses, and having a job is most important for people. Where employers and employees believe it's necessary to have such leave in contracts, they can do that right now, as businesses are already doing that. And as you know, the annual leave entitlements have been increasing over the years as well. So sympathetic to the idea, but to require it at such a large cost, that's not something that we're quite comfortable with yet.
Yeah, I guess you mentioned about like having a job as being very important, and I agree. And do you not think that without this kind of mandatory leave, women will have to take it anyway and then suffer the loss of their job from taking that when the employer hasn't kind of built that into the system?
Look, I've visited many employers, and many of them are compassionate about their employees, and they want to see their employees do well, because good employees mean that they do better for the businesses and for the organisations. And most employees that I've met, they're very sympathetic to supporting people if they're in a very difficult situation. This can already be done though, and we've got a big work program about trying to reduce domestic violence, about shining the light on the area, about giving the police more resources to assist, about giving other NGOs opportunities to gain more funding to work with victims of domestic violence. I don't think anyone could say that we don't care about the issue. We're just not sure that mandatory requiring 10 days leave, which would come at a cost to the economy, is something that is government should be doing when it can already be made available already.
Yeah, I guess obviously some employers wouldn't want to do that though, just because it might come at a loss for them. I guess doesn't that prioritise money over the safety of women and children in that case?
No. I think putting more resource and more assistance into helping victims of domestic violence is what is most important, and we're doing that. The legislation might assist in some areas, but you always have to weigh up the pros and cons, and I'd rather, as a country, we put more funding into support services, we put more funding into police services, we put more funding into providing safe opportunities for victims of domestic violence to get out of the family and have support. That's the priority, that's what we're focusing on. No amount of passing a law is going to solve the problem in one fell swoop. There's a whole range of measures that we're working on, and we'll continue to work on.
All right. Thank you, Jamie Lee. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too. That was National MP Jamie Lee Ross talking about the government voting against the domestic violence leave bill last week, and also National Party's Swimmable Rivers and Lakes goals announced this week. After the break, we'll have Radio Adelaide's Nicole Wedding with the latest in Australian news for Neighbourhood Watch.
It's summer.
95 BFM.
Dancing.
this summer. 95 SPF.
Yesterday, the government decided to move the goalposts because they know that New Zealanders want swimmable rivers, but they didn't set a plan to create swimmable rivers. They set a plan for business as usual, the continual pollution of our waterways, by actually just saying that what used to be wadeable can now be called swimmable. So that's pretty disappointing, and I think New Zealanders will have a right to be pretty upset about that.
Would you have preferred to see happen?
Well, we want genuine... Been going back, forth, around, around. Just can't seem to hold shit down. Get out of your head, lose your hesitation. Wasn't that what you said?
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
First story this week is all about coal.
Yes, this week Energy Minister Josh Frydenberg has been pushing to have clean coal classified as a green energy source, believe it or not. If you're thinking the term clean coal sounds like an oxymoron, I wouldn't argue with you on that one. The government are looking into changing the guidelines of the Clean Energy Finance Commission, which currently restricts the use of high-efficiency, low-emissions coal-fired energy plants. So basically, the government are using blackouts that happened in South Australia last year to, I guess, try and maybe even scare people into thinking that clean coal is the way forward, saying that events like the blackouts would have been avoided if Australia had an increased amount of baseload power. This is despite SA Power already publicly saying that the blackout had nothing to do with baseload power, but was due to infrastructure damage. And then on top of all this, the government wants to lift a restriction on the Clean Energy Finance Commission to allow them to invest in carbon capture and storage, which is the process of capturing carbon emissions and storing them underground. So it could be interpreted a number of ways, but to me it looks like the government realising that their clean coal would produce more emissions than a genuinely green energy source, and they want to do whatever they can to make coal look as good as they say it is.
It sounds like it's going backwards. Like,
I think most of the public doesn't associate coal with a green energy source. It seems far-fetched, but it's happening, so it's weird.
Yeah, definitely. Next story is about public holiday penalty rates.
Yeah. So full-time and part-time workers across Australia have been dealt a blow as the Fair Work Commission has ruled that the current penalty rates are too high. People working in the hospitality, retail, pharmacy and fast food industries will all receive a pay cut for any hours they work on Sundays. So these changes to the penalty rates affect nearly 500,000 workers in Australia, and it's been estimated this will cause some people to lose up to $6,000 a year. The irony, of course, is that penalty rates were originally brought in as an incentive to get people to work on the weekends, and companies used to whine, you know, that they didn't have the choice not to open up on a Sunday. But now that these companies have to compensate workers for giving up their Sundays, they complain about having to be open at all. So the Fair Work Commission's approach is to cut penalty rates with the hope that companies will be able to hire more people and also give others longer hours. But many, you know, can't help questioning this idea, because if you have a company that works well with a small number of staff, it doesn't really seem likely that they would suddenly add more people just because they can pay them the new penalty rates. You know, it seems like you would just keep that money that you're saving on wages as a profit. So I guess we'll see how this all plays out. And there's certainly been a lot of anger and a lot of discussion.
My understanding is that at the moment, people who work on Sundays get time and a half. Is that right?
I think like some people get double pay, and it's maybe going to time and a half. It varied for different industries.
At the moment in New Zealand, it's just the same kind of as any other day. But that's such a decrease for people who are working those hours.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess, you know, that kind of slippery slope argument comes into it. Like, we start with like one thing, and then are we going to like cut, you know, weekends in general, because like say Sundays are coming down to Saturdays, maybe those days will end up just being like weekdays, and you know, we're kind of getting like that 7-day working kind of mentality or culture, I guess, and then I don't know, it's interesting. I don't know if, I mean, this government certainly, like, wants to act in the interest of business owners, so I guess it's kind of predictable.
And then our last story today is a huge protest against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Australia.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, this very controversial figure has touched down in Sydney, and about 1,000 people gathered at the town hall to protest his visit, saying the warm reception that Australia has been giving him is embarrassing. So Netanyahu is here for a five-day tour that includes meeting federal government ministers. And our Prime Minister Turnbull has spoken about the strength of the friendship between Australia and Israel. But protesters, of course, are saying we need to criticise Netanyahu as he is responsible for settlement expansion, which is obviously a recurring flashpoint in the conflict between Israel and Palestine. But what should be interesting is Netanyahu's meeting with the federal opposition leader Bill Shorten, which is happening today, because Shorten has promised to raise the Labor Party's anti-settlement position. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens there.
Yeah, definitely. So Australia and Israel are obviously quite kind of tight-knit at the moment. Is that going to change, or has it changed at all, do you think, with the fact that the US is now Donald Trump? Like, Obama was obviously still sending a whole lot of money to Israel, but Trump has said and come out quite publicly in support of Israel, and that it's going to be kind of the closest administration to Israel that has ever been in the United States. And Australia is also a US ally. Do you think that's all going to shift a bit now?
I think it might. It depends on how, obviously, like, this party, the Liberal Party, how they do in the next election. I think that Australia definitely has a tendency to sort of keep quiet when it comes to something that the US that has a position on. We're not known to sort of contradict that at all or speak out, even though it seems like the public is generally... They don't seem to be huge fans of Netanyahu's, but of course this is just one protest. But it'll be interesting. I mean, I don't know. He's so controversial. I actually looked at, this is a little bit off topic, but I saw his flight route to Australia. It normally takes 7 hours to get from Singapore to Australia, but he took like this over 11-hour route because he had to avoid like certain airspace. and I don't know if Australia would ever be in opposition to him so much that he'll start avoiding Australia like that. Because we do have this long-standing relationship with the US. So in my opinion, it seems like we'll just follow, no matter what they do.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was Radio Adelaide's Nicole Whitting with all the latest in Australian news for Neighbourhood Watch. Before that, we had Sega Bodega's CC featuring Shy Girl. We also had Angel Olsen's Intern. Coming up next, Watercare are considering moving development of a new water plant outside of Oratia following local outrage. The company have proposed two other sites in West Auckland locations, which are protected ecological zones. BFM reporter Ashley McCall spoke to water supply manager Priyan Pereira about the issue.
We are, I guess, first of all, heartened by the response that the people have given us. We are wanting to work with the community. This is the start of our consultation process, and so we're getting to see their passion, the level of community in the different areas, and you know, this is the start of our feedback process. So all of the messages that we're getting from our from those residents will be taken on board by Watercare.
So locals claim that they were told about the new water treatment plant about 2 weeks ago, but that they understand the consultations have been happening within Watercare for the past 2 years. Is this true?
No, that's not true. We've been working on the replacement of the Hui water treatment plant over that time. What we've been working on, what we have spoken to others about, is the process for consultation. We haven't been consulting on the options. We've been going through an evaluation process internally, but we've not done any external consultation. This is the start of that process.
Will this public backlash influence Watercare's decision on what site they choose to build on?
We're obliged to go through the statutory process, and consultation is part of that process for us. So the feedback we get will be collated, and we'll be using that to determine a preferred site. So just to clarify, Watercare doesn't have a preferred option of the three that we have currently tabled. And this process will help us determine, and the feedback that we get from individuals and the conversations that we have with them will help us determine which option to take forward.
Okay, so building the site at Oratia will be the cheapest option of the three in terms of financial metrics, but how does the possible social cost of displacing 18 families from their homes get factored in?
So that's exactly what we're going through right now. So we've got people guiding us on the social impact. So we've obviously had the two meetings, so the one in Oratia and the one in Titirangi yesterday. So we have other people looking at the responses. We're collecting feedback via our website, and we're also collecting feedback via written responses that were submitted by parties during those meetings, and we'll be using that to add to the selection process. So it won't be solely on cost; it'll be a combined output based on a variety of factors. So that includes environmental, community impact, and cost.
From what I understand, the two alternative sites to the one at Oratia are in protected ecological zones with native bush. What would the process be if the plant was to be built at either of these sites?
So as we have evaluated on the existing sites, processes will be developed around any sort of significant ecological sites. And the resource consent will cover a lot of those issues and the conditions that will be imparted on water care if one is granted for any of the sites that we're looking at. Like I say, I'd just like to reaffirm the fact that this is the start of our consultation process. While we have been working on this work and working on this project internally for some time, we understand the community's concern, but we are going to be listening. So we're going to be spending quite a bit of time analysing the feedback, and we're going to go back to the community. So we want to meet with them again. We're going to talk to them again. Hopefully put together more one-on-one conversations with parties to get their feedback, and all of that will go into our decision-making process. But then beyond that, the process will become a statutory one, and it'll be one that will be dictated by independent commissioners, and they'll determine the final outcome.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Watercare Water Supply Manager Priyan Pereira talking about the location of their new water plant. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Remember, if you've got something to say about anything we're talking about today, feel free to text into 5395. We'd love to hear from you. Now, next up on the show today, producer Tess Barnett put together a report about the Dakota Access Pipeline.
US police are arresting the last of the Standing Rock protesters after a long-winded fight over the North Dakota pipeline project. Many months of protesting came to an end for the tribes of North Dakota after a final ruling allowed police to arrest the remaining protesters so they can go forth with the final piece of the pipeline. The pipeline began in December 2015 when US Army Corps of Engineers for the Obama District published a draft plan. The draft was initially open to comments from the public about environmental and cultural concerns. However, the tribes believe the Corps did not engage in adequate consultations regarding the pathway of the pipeline despite its disruption to culturally significant sites in Lake Oahe. Native American tribes in the area use Lake Oahe as a water source, and it holds historical and sacred sites near the crossing. In August 2016, construction workers arrived and were faced with roughly 30 individuals protesting the pipeline. This number only increased throughout the day. From Hooper Valley Tribe, Thomas Joseph spoke to The Guardian about the protesting.
We love this country. We love this land. And we'll do what we need to do to protect it. And if you look throughout the camp, you'll realize that it's not just Indigenous people here, that we have people of all faiths and of all races here standing up against corporate America to tell them that enough is enough and that our water comes before money.
Following these protests, many of which turned violent, a US District Court judge put the construction on hold in September. Despite the request to put a hold on the construction, in October the construction began again anyway. President Obama says in an interview that they were examining other routes for the pipeline over the following weeks while protests still continue. In December 2016, the Army Corps halt the construction again and say they intend to issue an environmental impact statement with full public input and analysis before it approves the river crossing at Lake Oahe. However, following President Trump's inauguration, he expedites the pipeline and the Army Corps terminate the period for public comments and revoke the notice of intent to prepare an environmental impact assessment. In February, the pipeline began construction again near the crossing under Lake Oahe. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe asked the US District Court to issue a restraining order to block construction of the final piece of the pipeline. This request is denied. The corps formally terminate the environmental review in a notice published on the 17th of February by the Federal Register. On February 22nd, North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum sets the deadline for the remaining protesters to leave the camps on federal land near the area of the company's construction site. The arrests are ongoing today and will continue until the remaining protesters are removed. This marks the end of a year-long battle, resulting in a sad loss for Native American tribes in North Dakota. Tess Barnett, BFM News.
Around up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
That was producer Tess Barnett talking about the situation at the site of the Dakota Access Pipeline. We were also just talking about how that was a very depressing end, but it is.
Very, very sad.
Yeah. After the break, we're going to have a look at the history of the Pride Parade ahead of tomorrow's parade.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
Swimming now.
That was Chelsea Jade with Night Swimmer. Lastly on today's show, the Auckland Pride Parade is tomorrow, so I took a little look at the history of Pride. June 28, 1969, Stonewall Inn in Manhattan's Greenwich Village was a gay bar. At the time, cross-dressing and homosexuality were considered mental illnesses and treated as criminal, so going to gay bars was a risk. Back in the 1960s, the Stonewall Inn was one of the few bars in Manhattan where people of the same sex could dance with each other without police harassment, mostly, which was only protected through alleged mafia ties. But people still went because for many this was the only place they could be themselves. But early in the morning of June 28th, a handful of police officers raided the inn. It erupted into a riot, with around 500 patrons fighting against police for the freedom to be themselves. The police officers took shelter in the inn, and rioters broke through the windows and doors. The violence escalated, cars were turned over, the street was on fire, hundreds of people were pushing and shoving outside the inn, people were fighting with each other. Eventually, New York City's tactical police force intervened, but rioters chased them out of the neighborhood too. The next night, people returned again to riot. This was the first time people were coming out on the streets to protest the rights and protection of the LGBT community. For many, this was the first time they could proudly declare their sexuality or gender identity, surrounded by people willing to fight for them and stand up against police discrimination. And sure, there were pockets of LGBT activism before Stonewall, but this event catapulted them forward. It wasn't the start of the LGBT activism, but is arguably the most influential. After the riots, people were energized to take action and join their local community groups and mobilized. Two people often left out of conversations about Stonewall who did make a huge impact on that night were transgender women of color, Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. While the raid and the riot that followed went down in history, Rivera and Johnson's contributions related to the uprising didn't make the news as much. In fact, as iconic as Stonewall was to the gay liberation struggle, it also became a symbol of a largely white, male movement that relegated people of color and women to the margins. Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera went on to spend their lives fighting for the queer community. They co-founded the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries, a group that worked with homeless drag queens and transgender women of colour in New York City. But where are we in New Zealand? Before colonisation, there is overwhelming historical evidence that same-sex Māori couples were accepted and celebrated in their communities. Colonisation brought European Christian laws to New Zealand and criminalised male homosexuality. It wasn't until July 9th, 1986, that this was legalised again, and only last month was it announced that these historic convictions could be quashed. In the 1980s, there was a major cultural shift around the world in the Stonewall riot commemorations. The previous loosely organised grassroots marches were taken over by more organised, less radical elements of the gay community. The marches began dropping liberation and freedom from their names under pressure from more conservative members of the community, replacing them with the philosophy of gay pride. In New Zealand, we now openly celebrate the queer community every year with many events such as the Big Gay Out and the Pride Parade, which is on tomorrow night. Even John Key celebrates it. ANZ decorated their ATM in rainbow colours and called it a gay-TM. However, many in the LGBT community see this as pinkwashing. When businesses that normally discriminate against queer people undertake actions to seem more queer-friendly in order to gain more customers and in the end make more money. In recent years, there's been an increasing corporatisation and commercialisation of Pride, which culminated in the events of the 2015 Pride Parade and the formation of queer activist group No Pride in Prisons. In 2015, it was announced that the New Zealand Police Force and Department of Corrections would march their members in uniform on horseback in the Pride Parade. Members of No Pride in Prisons saw this as unacceptable, considering institutional discrimination against Māori and the fact that Corrections regularly forces trans women to serve sentences in male prisons. No Pride in Prisons' Emily Rakete spoke out against the visibility and prioritisation of corporations and oppressive institutions, banks, and those members of Tamaki Makaurau's queer community who least need the movement at the violent exclusion of anyone who objected. This comes as the New Zealand police broke Emmy's arm for protesting their uniformed inclusion and denied her immediate medical treatment. This use of excessive force against a Māori trans woman while the police walked freely in uniform gives some insight into the state of pride in New Zealand. Emily also spoke of the fact that the body running the Auckland Pride Festival back in 2015 was an incorporated society instead of a charity, meaning that they had a vested financial interest in the event. But it's 2 years later, so where are we now? The police will not be marching in uniform in tomorrow's Pride Parade, but the ANZ GayTM is up again on Queen Street this year, so we'll see what happens. Amanda Jane Robinson, BFM News.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Friday the 24th of February. Thank you to everyone who came on the show. We had Lillian Hanley, Green MP Catherine Delahunty, National MP Jamie Lee Ross, Radio Adelaide's Nicole Wedding, Water Supply Manager Priyan Pereira. Also a big thank you to producer Tess Barnett.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, Tess. And News Director Shamina Smith. Murray's up next. I'm Amanda Jane Robinson. Have a lovely afternoon. This is Princess Nokia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.